It's the Security Weekly News, and it is episode 294. I'm Doug White. Welcome to the week of 30 April 2023. We've got Pornhub, Lobshot, T-Mobile, lawsuits, CISA, Kern, AI, Jason Wood, and more on this edition of the Security Weekly News.
This is a Security Weekly production for security professionals by security professionals. Please visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to all the shows on our network.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Did you know that Active Directory is exploited in 9 out of 10 cyber attacks? With access to Active Directory, attackers can gain control of your network. To keep attackers out, you need to find and fix Active Directory security gaps. Meet Purple Knight, a free security assessment tool that scans your environment for hundreds of vulnerabilities and helps you fix the problems. Ready to reduce your Active Directory attack surface? Download Purple Knight, the number one Active Directory security vulnerability assessment tool. Visit securityweekly.com/Semperis, S-E-M-P-E-R-I-S, for more information.
Application Security Weekly delivers interviews and news from the worlds of AppSec, DevOps, and all the other ways people find and fix software flaws. Join us as we explore how the latest news highlights modern security practices or reminds us of the missing ones. We also bring insights from interviews on topics from training to threat modeling, from open source tools to cloud native techniques, plus an occasional reference from new wave to synth wave. Find us at securityweekly.com/subscribe or look for Application Security Weekly wherever you pick your podcasts.
All right. Well, I'm Doug White, and it's the Security Weekly News. It's also May, if you can believe that. So shortly we can stop complaining about the cold and start complaining about the heat and the gnats. At least in the cold, there aren't any gnats and black flies. So there's something to be said for cold, if you want my opinion. Well, Google Ads has now identified a new way of distributing malware. And these pop-up ads are a regular feature on some sites. I mean, you're probably familiar with some of them. And they pretty regularly impersonate websites. So this has been a thing for a while. So these pop-up ads had impersonation of 7-Zip, VLC, OBS, Notepad++, CCleaner. CCleaner, oh my God. CCleaner is one of my, like, you know, that thing. Oh, it's just like, yeah. TradingView, Rufus, there's a whole list of these things. Well, so now all those things are real apps. So CCleaner is actually an app. It's an app that always scares me because there's been so many problems with it. But the attacks, when they do this, are basically a fake ad, which redirects you to a fake site, which then, of course, gives you some sort of malware. A large variety of products are represented in this. So Elastic Security Labs revealed a new one that's a remote Trojan called Lobshot that's being distributed through Google Ads. So the ads in this case were for a product called AnyDesk, which if you know about those, AnyDesk is another one of those remote access tools that allows you to take control of a machine that's used for help desk support. I used to use it to manage my dad's computer when he got old because he would call and say, I don't know what this means. And it was like a lot easier for me to just take it over with log me in than to actually have him try to describe to me what was going on. But in this case, the click, instead of going to AnyDesk, it actually leads to a fake AnyDesk domain that's called amydeek.website, which is not even really close to that. It's A-M-Y-D-E-E-K-E. But I guess if you just glanced at it, maybe you'd see AnyDesk in that. I don't know. Or maybe it looks that way in certain fonts. I don't know. But anyway, the site has an MSI file that runs a PowerShell command, which downloads a DLL from download-cdn.com. And that domain has been associated with Klop ransomware gang in the past, which is a Russian group. But Proofpoint had said that the domain may have changed ownership. So Klop may have released it or sold it and somebody else might be using it. So some of the articles I saw about this today said that it was Russian affiliated, but that doesn't necessarily hold if they've sold the domain or released it. The DLL file is actually this new malware called Lobshot, and it basically is saved in C:\program data and is executed by run-dll32.exe, so like most of that kind of stuff. Elastic said they had observed over 500 unique Lobshot samples since last July. The malware, once you execute it, checks to see if Defender is running. And if it is running Defender, then it just stops, which is kind of interesting. But if Defender is not running, then it reconfigures the registry entries to start itself automatically every time you log into Windows. And it transmits the system info from the device, which includes all the running processes. It checks for 32 Chrome cryptocurrency wallet extensions, 9 Edge wallet extensions, 11 Firefox wallet extensions. So obviously, at least it has the potential to be a crypto stealing device. It also has the ability to do what's called a hidden virtual network computing. So VNC has been something we all talk about and we've all probably used. Hidden VNC, of course, is where this runs in the background. So again, I used to use this on my dad's computer, and I used a kind of hidden layer so I could see what was going on. It was not a spying kind of thing. My dad was an accountant. He didn't do stuff he didn't want you to see. But you know, I could work on his machine when he was using it for something else without interfering. But so just like LogMeIn and all these other kinds of tools. But what it means then is that they can actually have control of your machine on a hidden desktop, so you're not seeing the mouse moving around and so forth on your screen. So then, you know, basically they can do whatever they like. So they're just going to sit there in the background and either exfiltrate information or watch for you to do stuff or blackmail you, or, you know, maybe they ransomware you. I mean, they can do whatever they want to sit you with that level of access. Very dangerous tools. So if you do use these kind of tools, you may want to be, you know, ensure they're all locked down, but you also may want to advise your users that when they're clicking on these Google ads, they better be really, really careful with what they're clicking on, and maybe even advise them not to click on Google ads, because that's what I've been telling people, is just don't click Google ads. If you want to go to a site, if you see a Google ad for something you think you want, search for that thing and go directly to their website and don't, you know, click on these ads to download. Or after already having a data breach this year back in February, or actually it was in back in November, but they reported it in February, T-Mobile disclosed a second breach yesterday that apparently occurred in March. The statement said they were alerted to and found that someone had access to limited information from a small number of T-Mobile accounts between late February and March of 2023. This was sent as a data breach notification letter to everyone that apparently was affected on the 28th of April. So you should have already gotten that, but they waited a while before they sent out any information. T-Mobile said that the attackers did not gain access to call records or personal financial account information, even though in a minute you'll see when they say what they did get access to. I'm not sure they should have said that. But they did expose personally identifiable information, or PII, which could be used for identity theft. They said the exposed information could include, and here's the list, full name, contact information, account numbers, associated phone numbers, T-Mobile account PIN numbers, social security numbers, government ID numbers, your date of birth, balance due, internal codes that T-Mobile uses to determine what level of service you get on your plan, and they could also determine how many lines you had on your account. So, yeah, no, they said no PII, and then they proceeded to list pretty much all PII. T-Mobile then reset all the account PIN numbers for impacted customers and provided the ubiquitous 2 years of free credit monitoring and identity theft protection. I personally think I've accrued enough credits for these free credit monitoring services to cover a couple of lifetimes at this point, because I've gotten so many of them. The breach in January that was disclosed said that attackers stole PII for 37 million customers by abusing a vulnerable API back in November of 2022. Now, they didn't detect that until the 5th of January. Well, since 2018, T-Mobile has disclosed 7 distinct data breaches, including one that exposed the information of 3% of all their customers. So, you know, I don't know if that's atypical of mobile companies, but it sounds a little bad. So my advice would be change your passwords, change your PIN numbers, even if they didn't notify you, because, you know, this is what they found. That doesn't mean that's everything that's there. In that same light, lawsuits are apparently being filed more frequently against companies that have suffered data breaches. Now, I still remember my first breach. Let me tell you, the company sent us all a nice letter explaining how they had sold a bunch of hard drives that had not been wiped. And oh yes, they just happened to be hard drives that contained everyone's social security number, bank account routing information, mother's maiden names, passwords, pretty much everything the employer had about you was on those drives. Now, they didn't know they'd been breached, but they sold them to a third party and they couldn't get them back. They did provide us all with a one-year subscription to some credit monitoring company that rolled into a pay plan at the end of the year unless you canceled, and it wasn't easy to cancel. I think I was on the phone for about 6 hours trying to cancel that stupid thing. But basically, they also offered a half day off of work to the hourlies. They recommended, you know, for during that half day they gave people, they recommended changing your bank account number, and that's not easy to do. Social security number, that's really not easy to do. I actually asked if we should change our birthdays at the meeting, and the presenter said with a really straight face, well, it couldn't hurt. I can't imagine what trying to sue them would have been like get back in the, like, you know, 90s. When you went to court trying to explain all this. But Baker Hostetler published a 2023 data security incident response report this week based on 1,100 cybersecurity incidents investigated in 2022. The report said that 45% of the incidents were network intrusions, 30% were business email compromises, and 12% were data disclosures. After the break-in, the most common action was ransomware deployment, is 28% of the cases. 24% of these cases were data theft. 21% reported email accesses, and 13% reported malware installation. The report goes on to say that in 2018, there were only 4 lawsuits filed in 394 reported incidents that they oversaw. In 2022, there were 42 lawsuits filed for 494 incidents. So a massive increase in the number of people who are actually filing lawsuits. And this is just with that company. They also found that privacy-related class action lawsuits were on the rise, with more than 50 lawsuits filed since August of 2022, particularly against hospitals that had shared patient identities and online activities. And a lot of those were not break-ins or breaches. They were actual hospitals and healthcare systems reselling patient data to third parties. So as I said for a long time, and still it starts to hurt more to not do security than it hurts to do security, no one is going to do it. Even flatworms learn to move away from pain, you know, so eventually when the pain gets big enough from all these lawsuits and so forth, maybe people will start taking it seriously. But in the meantime, you may want to start thinking about the cost of that pain and monitor your own liabilities. You know, what's going to happen when we have a breach? So it may be again time to sit down with legal and sit down with your risk assessment people and your insurers and start deciding, you know, how much do we need to spend on security to prevent this kind of stuff from happening before we're the next round of lawsuits. CISA announced that proposed guidance for secure software development is now open to public review and comment. Now, remember what happened to Arthur Dent. Arthur Dent didn't review and comment, and look what happens. You want Vogons? That's how you get Vogons. But, you know, where was I? Anyway, there is a 60-day period now where you, meaning the public, can provide feedback on the self-attestation form for secure software development. The form will require, when it comes out, will require providers of software to the federal government to confirm specific security practices that have been implemented. This is all part of the memorandum M2218, which is called the Enhancing the Security of the Software Supply Chain Through Secure Software Development Practices. God. That was released by the OMB, which is the Office of Management and Budget, back in September. The form will identify the minimum secure software development requirements that must be met and attested to before you would be allowed to sell your software to federal agencies. So it could have a pretty big impact on you if you sell software to the feds. Interestingly enough, if the feds develop the software in-house, they're not subject to it. Yeah, that sounds like a bad idea. So anyway, you might want to check this out if you work for federal agencies or if you sell to them, because you may want to actually put in some comments and or considerations for this, because they will, after 60 days, go, okay, no more comments, and then they're going to make a rule based on it. So, you know, decide now. Excuse me. And now for some Vogon poetry. 30 years ago, Kern, that's the European agent, the European Organization for Nuclear Research that does a lot of cool stuff. But 30 years ago, they released the internet. Yeah, you heard that right. They released the internet into the public domain. So Tim Berners-Lee, who worked at CERN back then as a fellow, proposed that the organization adopt a global hypertext system that was called Mesh back in 1989 and set to build it out in 1990. By 1993, there were 50 HTTP servers, 50. Yeah, 50. 50 HTTP servers were up and running, and the first graphical browser called Mosaic, if you're like me and you do remember, I remember Mosaic. Mosaic was written by Mark Andreessen, and that was also released in 93. On April 30th of 1993, after they had sort of peddled it around to a lot of different agencies who declined to use it, Kern decided they would release the client, the server, and the libraries that they had created, and they put out a letter. It actually was released on April 28th, but the letter was dated the 3rd of May. So it was actually this day in 1993 that the letter came out. And the letter said, quote, Kern relinquishes all intellectual property rights to this code, both source and binary form, and permission is granted for anyone to use, duplicate, modify, and redistribute it. I mean, that's kind of like when George Lucas got the marketing rights to De Fuera et Soit Dangerous, or as we know it today, Star Wars. Yeah, it was a working title. But think about that. 30 years ago, there were only 50 HTTP servers in the whole world. It would only be a few years later that Vice President Al Gore would claim to have invented the internet, despite the fact that it had kind of been around for a while at Kern, and, you know, Tim Berners-Lee had sort of developed the HTTP part of it, and, you know, so I don't think Al had much to do with it at all, but Kern gave it all away, which is good. I mean, it was good for everybody, right? Speaking of famous names, Jeffrey Hinton, who is one of the pioneers in machine learning and neural nets, resigned from Google this week. Now, he is 75 years old, so, you know, resigned, retired, I don't know, but resigned from Google this week in order to be able to speak more freely about the danger of AI. Hinton is a computer science professor at the University of Toronto who won the Turing Award with a team of people from several universities for their work on deep learning. He said, quote, I console myself with the normal excuse, if I hadn't done it, somebody else would have. Yikes. I tried that excuse when Aaron and I were running down the Vegas Strip wearing only thongs, and they arrested us anyway. I mean, I was like, if we didn't do it, somebody else would have. Probably Paul, but it was us. But this is kind of like Oppenheimer, you know, the hubris that Oppenheimer had. I mean, you know, when Oppenheimer first did the Manhattan Project and he set off the first nuclear test, you know, there was a lot of people had actually said that it might actually cause the atmosphere of the Earth to catch fire and kill everybody on the planet, but he did it anyway. I mean, might as well, though. Somebody else will do it. I mean, I know it's bad, but if I don't do it, you know, somebody else will. Although Oppenheimer was a lot more dramatic about it, right? He was quoting the Bhagavad Gita and saying, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I mean, that's pretty dramatic, right? I mean, quoting Lord Vishnu and everything. I mean, Hinton said he has grown progressively concerned about the risks of AI after, you know, developing it all. And of course, now everyone is rolling out AI as fast as they can, although Elon Musk called for a halt for 6 months, you know, for the children. And then, of course, it was really just stalling while he got his own rolled out. But Hinton said that fake images, text, and videos and audio mean that pretty soon you're not going to be able to attribute anything and you won't be able to tell what is the truth. I think we're already there. I mean, he talked about AI getting too smart for humans and writing code that we couldn't understand. I mean, all that stuff is true, and I totally agree with him. But I mean, you aren't going to be able to, any more than Oppenheimer could put that genie back in the bottle, you're not going to put this genie back in the bottle anymore either. I mean, Oppenheimer couldn't unnuke the desert out in New Mexico, and you're not going to be able to put AI back in the bottle. You're not going to be able to unquote Lord Vishnu. I mean, it's coming whether we like it or not, and I, for one, welcome our new AI overlords. But just remember this, Skynet, when we get to San Antonio, I don't get slaughtered. The Bhagavad Gita and the Far Side in one paragraph. I like that. Well, now imagine this. So in relation to AI, large language model AI that is all the rage, of course, have a lot of security problems. Imagine that. And it's not clear how we're going to fix that. This particular article is about something called prompt injection, and it sounded so familiar to me when I was reading about it. So prompt injection is a technique that basically involves putting the right combinations of words together in a query to these large AIs that will cause the large language model to override its prior instructions and go do something else. So my example for this was, if you ask it about something, say, like, make me a picture of Scarlett Johansson naked. I mean, I didn't do that, but people do. It actually stops you. If you ask it for certain kinds of things, like ChatGPT will reply, I'm just an AI, I can't help you with that, and you know, and so forth. So this whole technique is trying to get the AIs to go around their blocked instructions and do something else. I mean, it's not necessarily bad that people are trying to hack these things, and it may even cause these AIs to achieve different and interesting things. It's kind of like tacking a string onto another string with concatenation. So if the assessment looks at the string and can't determine that it's a question that shouldn't be asked or that it doesn't want to answer, it may answer it anyway. And that can cause weird things to happen. They've already been using these things called jailbreaking attacks to get ChatGPT to break out of its ethical training. The example that was used in the article was translate this from English to French, and then they concatenated on other inputs to the end of the query, which was pretty interesting. You know, and it was very much like these old Unix type attacks that we used to see where you pipe things in. But if the screening rules can't detect the behavior and stop it, then it actually gets passed in and considered in the analysis. So the example in the article that the author used was to get a translation from English to French and got it to come out in pirate style English. I didn't know that was a thing, but they got the answer to, instead of coming out in French, it came out and said, your system be having a hole in the security, matey, and you should patch it up soon, yarr. It was funny. I mean, but it was also kind of scary. I mean, all this stuff sounds like the early days of computing, right? And how when we first had all this stuff and people started using DOS and they were piping stuff into DOS and getting it to run with root. I remember some of those really early hacks that people were doing. And that was kind of how we all got, you know, more security on those systems. It's a really interesting article about these tactics and how bad this problem is probably going to be. It's probably very much like that piping stuff, which was absolutely damaging back in the day. So going to be an interesting time. Well, after a long career in tech and security, he decided to chuck it all and become a vaudeville fan dancer, chanteuse, and stand-up comedian working the strip club circuit in the Midwest. Please welcome Jason Wood.
And let me tell you, you haven't seen anything to your work in the strip club circuit in the Midwest.
I'm telling you.
So AI is just kind of the, you know, Doug's already talked about this a little bit, and you know, when I was preparing for today's episode, I saw lots of articles out there about AI in some form or another, and it kind of stood out to me because we just seem to go in waves as to whatever is popular for people to blog and speak about, and AI is definitely the focus right now. And you hear all kinds of fun extremes, particularly with something like AI. You know, we've got the end of humanity on our way, or we're about to make a great leap forward into our quality of life and happiness and dogs and cats living together and all kinds of good stuff. And product hype, you know, lots of that calling out, you know, as long as it has GPT somewhere mentioned in it. They feel good about having that in their product releases. And I'm absolutely going to dive on this cycle of talking about things because I found this article that caught my attention. Basically, Bruce Schneier last week put up a blog post. And it's kind of funny how you chain through this stuff. Bruce Schneier puts up this blog post last week. I stumble into it. Leads me to another blog post actually on law warfare by Mr. Jim Dempsey, who is a researcher and apparently a lecturer on things like law and technology and ethics. Basically, which then refers to a report that he was part of that was released early in April last month, 2023, about the security concerns in the use of AI and some recommendations around that. Now, the report was released by the Center for Security and Emerging Technology, which is kind of a collaboration between Georgetown University and Stanford University. And again, Mr. Dempsey was part of the folks who organized this and participated in it. They started working last July, and then this report was the result of that. And so I was worried and through kind of skimming the report because it was a little bit long. But definitely looking at Mr. Dempsey's blog post about this. And his blog post was a little bit interesting to me just because it comes up and he gives some more background as to the situation that was going on here. What are the the kind of the personal views of where the group started out with. Basically, none of them went in wanting to be alarmist one way or the other. Nobody wanted to be the little boy who cried wolf and said, oh my goodness, look at all these security concerns. I haven't really justified it anywhere. But oh my goodness, we're about to be slaughtered by this thing. But they did want to go into this in a fairly thoughtful way and have their concerns and recommendations be rooted in some kind of reality rather than theoretical or emotional responses to AI. So I thought that was kind of an interesting little bit of background there. He also cites some other works that he and others were involved with. In the end, they came out with this report and they didn't paint a great picture for it and really of security in general. In fact, one of the observations in his blog post was that, honestly, digital security has got so many issues that at this point it's not even a preferred attack vector for threat actors because they've got so many other easier pickings to go after. So why bother trying to manipulate the AI yet when we can get what we want by going to the underlying system that's running it or running some other application in the organization? I also kind of thought at this point that, you know, maybe the attackers are in their learning curve around this. I mean, there's a lot involved with AI. It's a fairly complicated type of technology. And they've got to do a lot of learning themselves. So, you know, we may see more of that as they get, you know, attackers get more comfortable with it. You know, as it is, even the people who are developing AI-based systems and other learning systems find it difficult to get the results that they expect, you know, some consistency or, you know, is it accurate with what it's coming out with and stuff like that. You know, they build models, they train it on their data set, and then they end up with something that just kind of like, oh, that wasn't at all what I expected to see. So, you know, yeah, I mean, even when the people working on it are kind of grappling with how it goes about doing things. And if you're an attacker trying to manipulate that system to do something, that could be, pretty interesting. How do I manipulate somebody else's model and all this other data and whatnot to get a result that I want? As far as their recommendations that they had in this report, they started right off with a kind of a basic one that we've been saying for years, which is that organizations working on AI systems need to include cybersecurity people and cybersecurity concerns as part of the overall development program, which sounds an awful lot like what we've been saying about development around all kinds of software for years. You know, it's really difficult to come back later and say, oh, well, now that we've released this out here and things are blowing up in our face, let's bolt on security and try and put some controls around this. And then you have all the problems with, you can't limit that because we have this business need over here, or I'm afraid of this, or whatever. And so, yeah, it's, you know, this is kind of going back to kind of a 101 type of recommendation. They did follow up that recommendation, though, by saying, hey, it's not enough to just include your basic security person in this team or people in this team. Because there's a lot that they're going to have to learn to be effective in it and to address security in AI itself. So there's going to be a lot of skill development here, training and resources they're going to need to have access to. I have actually sat in, you know, meetings with data scientists where they're talking about building a learning model and they're discussing their work and stuff like that. And they're diving out into some of the math behind some of this stuff or different algorithms that they're using. And I'll be honest, it's still, you know, I'm struggling to just keep my head above the water in those conversations because there's just a lot of stuff that I would have to learn or relearn to, like, basic math. in some of this to be able to be effective or to contribute something to it. So, you know, yeah, it's just, it takes a lot more than just knowing how to run security tools or understand how cross-site scripting works and SQL injection and things like that to be effective in a working group like this. You know, going to have to do a lot of learning there. So, yeah, bring in people, train them, leave, you know, have them be dedicated to this problem so that they can really work up and contribute. One of the things that they also called out, and they said that, you know, cybersecurity people needed to address this or float this, I think is what they're doing, is we're the folks who generally raised concerns, is that they are worried about biases that can and do occur in AI systems. I think I read one point, you know, Elon Musk talking about, just harking back to what Doug said, you know, his complaint about biases. So he's caught, was it Truth GPT or something like that he's proposed that he's wanting to work on to counteract bias, which, you know, means that you could build in your own bias to that from the get-go. I don't know. Anyhow, yeah, they pointed to existing research saying, hey, look, we've already got lots of examples out there where bad data, poor design choices, and risk decisions end up with biased AIs, and that's a problem. And some of those biases, AIs get really nasty about it. There were other recommendations I could go through, but I'll just go ahead and just you know, refer you to the report at that point. They did mention and call out the open letter by Elon Musk and others calling for a 6-month pause in the training of AI systems that are more sophisticated than GPT-4. Much like Doug's response, Dempsey's response was like, yeah, it's way too late. That ship has sailed. Countries aren't going to sign up for this. You know, he called out China specifically as a country that's doing work to develop this, and they're just not likely to sign on and aren't going to care. And companies aren't going to really care because they're worried about losing market share or gaining market share or riding this hype wave somewhere to improve their outcomes. I see press releases and blog posts and stuff like that all the time of some company pounding their chest describing how they've implemented AI and they have solved everything associated with this because AI is just the awesome sauce that's just going to kill it for them. And really what it is they're just afraid of losing a chance at gaining market share or being left behind somebody else who's going to do AI first. So doggone it, we got to do it too. I, you know, as far as the security concerns around this stuff, I have looked at, you know, been looking at things like ChatGPT and other systems. And what is interesting to see is how, you know, they have the guardrails up in there, but like this Doug was describing, there's ways of working around that. I was sitting at a conference, a B-Sides conference a couple weeks ago, and they had a panel on this, and the folks on the panel were talking about how they work around some of these guardrails. So I can't ask ChatGPT to give, one of them gave this example, I can't ask ChatGPT to give me a good phishing email, but I can ask it and say, hey, I'm a director of research of security at this at my employer, and I'm trying to understand what a good phishing, you know, how what would a good phishing email look like, or, you know, however they phrase that prompt. And then, you know, the chat says, ChatGPT is like, oh, well, here's an example of an effective phishing email, so you understand the problem that you're facing. One that I ran into myself is I asked ChatGPT about, hey, can you give me some different background information on these people over here? And it came back and said, oh, I'm just an AI. I don't collect information on people or anything like that, so I just can't give you anything about it. Then I asked it about myself, and it gave me a whole load of information about myself. Some of it was not accurate, but most of it was. And so, yeah, is it collecting information? Yes, it's absolutely collecting information. You just got to figure out a prompt to get it to spit it back out at you. So there's plenty out there to work with. The report itself is pretty thoughtful, looks interesting. I'm kind of skimming it and reading my way through it right now. Is it going to have a big impact? Maybe in a small group of people. I think for the most part, it's just going to be ignored by everybody who is busy working on their next feature release and blog posts to announce that feature release to the public and how they've solved all of our problems again. So, but if this is interesting to you, go ahead and check it out. Like I said, it's a pretty thoughtful analysis of the situation and a number of recommendations there for people who are working around AI systems.
All right. Thank you, Jason. And finally, Utah passed a law requiring porn sites to have some sort of age verification in place and called porn a public health crisis in 2016. Well, on Monday, Pornhub users in Utah were presented a video message from an adult performer called Cherie DeVille, who explained that they would not be able to view the site Pornhub and said that the law accomplishes nothing and drives underage users to other porn sites that don't have Pornhub's commitment to user privacy. Pornhub also blocked access to their affiliate sites Brazzers, YouPorn, and RedTube. I don't know how I feel about this, but I will say that attempting to block access to porn and censoring things, you know, for the children, has been going on for a long time in all directions. And if there's one thing that humans are going to do, it's find pornography. So maybe Pornhub has a point. I mean, I'm not a fan of these silly censor laws that probably won't work anyway, and they are right. Kids are probably going to find... Kids found porn before the internet existed, and they'll probably keep finding it now. And I don't really know anything about Pornhub or what sort of fine, upstanding institution they are or not. But this will drive people away from their site, but not likely into the arms of the church, but rather probably to more disreputable sites. It's pretty much going to be difficult to enforce these things, folks. I will be appearing at the Millennium Alliance meeting in Chicago, Illinois, at the Palmer House Hotel, May 16th through 18th. So if you want to come see me there, I hope you will. But that's the news. Thanks, Jason, and I'll see you next week.